Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I found a picture of you. Those were the happiest days of my life.
Chrissy Hynde sang about finding a picture and remembering earlier times in this song, Back on the Chain Gang, with her band The Pretenders.
Life of a lonely heart. Now we're back on the train.
Recently, she's been looking back in pictures and words in a new memoir called Reckless, My Life as a Pretender. The book recounts her life as a young woman desperate to start a band and willing to go to London to do it. Also, someone given to some pretty reckless behavior. There's a lot more to the book as well, as you'll hear in this wide-ranging and kind of freewheeling interview with Chrissy Hynde that we recorded in WNYC's ground floor performance venue, The Green Space. I'm John Schaefer, and this is a special extended edition of the Soundcheck podcast. It's also full of salty language, the kind of thing we could never get away with broadcasting on the air. But this is how it sounded in front of a large and enthusiastic audience in the Green Space. And we began by talking about the book. Why this book now?
Well, I never really wanted to write a book. And a lot of people say over the years, you should write a book, which, you know, is guaranteed I'm not going to write a book. And people keep telling me to write one.
So did someone say, Chrissy, don't write a book?
No mas. Well, you know, it's just I had some perspective on things. Now that I'm in my 60s, so, you know, I could say things that... the book ends a long time ago.
Did you read Viv Albertine's memoir?
I leafed through it. I'm not real big on memoirs. I haven't read a lot of them, and I pick them up in bookstores and stuff,
and I tell the authors
that I know that I've read them.
Well, Viv Albertine of the Slits, her memoir came out earlier this year, and it's kind of the opposite of yours because it's, you know, most of it takes place after the band breaks up, and it's her in the later years, whereas... this book is really kind of almost like a part one of your life story, it seems. Was it intended?
No, No, I didn't really have a plan. But I, sorry, am I okay backing away like this so I'm not hearing my voice out there?
Although, as a radio producer who's going to have to edit this later, okay. I may just be swinging
that. If I hear
that.
My voice, I...
So you can lean back, but I may lean that mic right back into you.
Talk very quiet. Well, I wouldn't have written this book if my parents were alive, and I say that in the beginning, and I feel like a big hypocrite, and I know that's pretty shitty of me, and I feel bad about it, but I did so much behind their back, I suppose a little more won't hurt.
On that same front page, the prologue of the book, you also say that I regret half of this, and the other half is the sound that you heard.
Yeah, so I guess that means I regret all of it.
There are many, many episodes of bad choices and bad behavior and getting yourself into bad situations.
Not so many, though, really. I mean, I think it's more of the story of my generation.
Mm.
And, I mean, my feeling was that this was the story that, you know, just was anyone in my generation. And I didn't intend for it to go into that. Like I was saying to you earlier, this is kind of like the light version of my story. I don't really get into anything messy or anything that's too graphic, or it's not a kiss and tell. I don't really say anything personal about people. This is much more the, you know, like I say, reckless light.
Mm-hmm.
But
do you regret pretty much?
Yeah, fuck yeah. You know, I mean, I don't understand this. I don't regret anything. I mean, I regret a lot, and I'm very sorry about a lot. You know, it's too late now, though.
Mm-hmm. But if you had changed things, would you have left Akron? Would you have gone to London? Would you have formed a band?
I mean, I know, but who can answer those questions? That doesn't exist. It is what it is.
And yet it doesn't stop me from posing them, does it?
Would I? Who knows? Yeah. I mean, give me a for instance, and I'll tell you what my answer would be. If I'd been a straight A student.
I was going to say, as the father of two daughters, you know, who've gone through their teen years, I wouldn't expect the straight A student. I would expect my daughters not to go into a house with five bikers when they're out of their mind, blotto on lewds or whatever.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you probably wouldn't. But this is we were talking about the late 60s in this book.
Yeah.
And in the late 60s, it was a different world. And all the bikers looked like hippies. And we wanted to be hippies, and we wanted to hang out with hippies. But the bikers had motorcycles, which made them much cooler than hippies. And they had all the drugs. So, you know, we were kind of like featuring them. And they were at all the gigs. They were up front at all the gigs being security guards and stuff. So, you know, we wanted to get, you know, and they didn't come, they didn't hurt anyone who was under 21.
Mm-hmm.
And we were too naive to, you know, put two and two together there.
Right. Not hearing a whole lot of regret in your voice there, but...
I was having fucking ball. Are you kidding?
You refer to them constantly in the book as the heavy, capital H, bikers, capital B.
Uh-huh.
They're clearly Hell's Angels. Why?
I'm not saying who they are. There was a lot of bike groups then.
Okay.
A lot of outlaw factions.
So you're just kind of using that as a generic...
Yes, I am.
All right. Okay. I thought maybe Hell's Angels had, like, retained legal counsel or something to stop people
from... They retain a certain legal counsel. They do indeed.
Okay. The instance that I brought up, that you and five bikers in this place, and then there's another one that happens later in London, both times you are very kind of clear about saying, I put myself in this position.
Yeah, that seems to be the story now. When I was telling my story, I just kind of... through that was an aside.
Yeah.
That, well, you know.
And yet, this is the thing.
No,
that has
no
kind
one
of
else
blown
did
up.
This shit. It was, you know, I did a lot of stuff that, you know, most intelligent people wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's you know, and.
But there are two ways of looking at it. The one is, all right, well, she's not playing the victim card. Yeah, but to say it's your fault sort of absolves the other.
You know what?
Party
I'm not telling anyone what to do. I'm not giving any advice. I'm not telling anyone what they should wear, who they should fuck, how they should think. You know, I'm telling my story. If you don't like it, don't buy the fucking book. I've only ever advised one thing in my whole, this since I've been here, since 1969. My only advice is don't kill animals. I've never changed my line.
In the hall while waiting for their number to get called out. I found out what the wait was about. I was a good time. Yeah, I got pretty good. Changing tires upstairs, bro. I shot my mouth off and you showed me what that holds.
Do you think titling the book Reckless and kind of serving up this, is it a cautionary tale?
I guess not. I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know what that means exactly, but I was in two minds at the end. I thought maybe it should be called Restless because it seemed more appropriate. And I think the publisher was like, no, we like Reckless. It's more rock and roll.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, they don't really know what rock and roll is, but if they like it, then, you know, that's good for me. And I didn't think about that title when I started the book. It's only when I got to kind of the end of the book and I started thinking, God, how many funerals have I been to now in this book? You know, how many people have I buried? And the point, again, that's my story, but it's the story of my generation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think everyone here, I'm guessing, has been to the funeral of someone where that's the best place in town to score that day. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there's people, you know, they die when they take drugs. But, you know, this doesn't stop other people from taking them, and it doesn't stop people from scoring at their funerals.
Well, you know, we've mentioned this opening page. You know, you mentioned mom and dad being gone, the regret half, the other half. And then the last line of that page is, and so here it is, girls.
Oh, that was I've always said when I get on stage, for some reason, I say, are you ready, girls? Because there's always... There's always a few of the same lunatics up the front. You know, so I'm acknowledging. I try not to look at them, and I'm trying not to, you know, let them creep me out. But I know they're there, so I'm just like, okay, here we go. So that was a nod to the, you know, to the ardent.
Okay.
The ardent wackos that have followed me.
So, did you have a reader in mind when you wrote the book?
No, huh? Is that how... do people do that when they write books? I don't know.
I don't know.
I think that woman who wrote 50 Shades of Puke must have had a reader. You know, a few million of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was only just telling my story. I didn't, you know, right. I didn't even know it was going to be a book.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think just to come back to, you know, this whole brouhaha that's happened with, you know, you saying, well, I take responsibility mm-hmm. for what happened to me. I think the reason it became such a
big deal. I don't even think I said
deal.
That. I mean, I said, first of all, I haven't read any of the press, and I haven't read any reviews, and I haven't read, but I did get a few, you know, emails after the, you know, whatever it was that happened.
I think was it the Times of London or the Washington Post?
Women always prod me to try to say, you know, that I've had such a hard time.
Yeah.
You know, you're not allowed to lie back and enjoy it. But, no, in fact, I never said any of that. I never said rape. I never said anything about the Hells Angels. I never said any of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never said that I ever had sex with Iggy Pop. I've never said any of those things. It's not in the book. You know, so suddenly I'm defending something I haven't said. This is like when I facetiously said at a press conference for Greenpeace, when they asked what concessions I'd made to the environment, and I said I firebombed McDonald's. And then a few days later, well, the next day, a McDonald's did get firebombed.
Mm.
And, you know, I mean, I'd love to take credit for that. Of course I would. But, you know, it was nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know, so there you go. You know, it's, once again, I'm defending something I never...
Well, and I think the reason you find yourself in that position is because people have come to look at you as this kind of feminist icon, you know, the woman who made her own way in a male-dominated field.
Well, you know, that's
not, whether you wanted that or not is another question.
I'm, you know, I don't talk it, I walk it, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm the poster girl for feminism. Anyway, I mean, the conversation goes on and on. You know what? This conversation starts with people under 30.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have a whole, these girls have a whole different take on it. That's what I'm learning now. And I didn't really go into this to, I didn't even care. But I have been, now that's what I'm finding out.
So is it, do you think it's different for women under 30 who are in maybe not the rock world, but in the pop music world these days? I mean, do you see a kind of pressure to look a certain way?
I think the only person that pressures you to do anything is yourself.
Let's come back.
It's attention seeking.
Uh-huh.
That's what it is.
Well,
it's
that's the name of the game in pop, isn't it?
And I think that, well, I don't know if it is. I mean, you know, Jimi Hendrix didn't have to set his guitar on fire.
I'm making a distinction between pop and rock.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know that rock exists anymore so much, you know, so I don't know where it's going. I don't know what yeah. I have a feeling it's coming back, actually. I do. I didn't think so until recently, but I've seen a couple good bands lately.
And there are some really good bands.
I think that people are kind of fed up with this reality stuff and this pop stuff and this... They are fed up with it. They're fed up with it. And generally, and I'm sensing this because I have been trying to sell my fish and hawk this book, you know. So I have been talking to people, and the feedback I've got has been very much, you know, like I was talking to one guy, and I was saying, there's no bands anymore. It's over. And, you know, I just wish I could see bands again in small places. It's got too big. They're in stadiums. It's just, and he said, I have a band and we play in pubs. And I went, you do? And he goes, yeah. And I said, fuck it, I'm going to get in a band. And at the end of this year, I'm going to get in a band with some people who don't play any better than me, which is not how I did it in the first place. That was the secret to my success. They were all really good. Now I'm going to go back to basics, just, you know, getting some... I've already got the band. And, you know, we're going to play in pubs.
The end of this year.
Yeah, the end of this year. And we're called... We're called The Fools, by the way.
The Fools.
And we've got... And then I was in Akron, Ohio about a month ago. And, you know, there's a little club there, Musica, which is a really cool club that a friend of mine has put together. And And he said, oh, there's a band playing, and they're all going on in a half an hour. And I said, okay, well, you know, let's go back and say hi. So we went back, and I said hi. And then I thought, oh, shit, now they know I'm here, and they know who I am. So now I'm obliged to watch them, or it would be impolite just to leave. So having, you know, clearly lost my faith in bands, I guess. So I stood there, and I was, you know, I suppose I was being my usual cynical, hateful self. And I couldn't move for the next hour. I was rooted to the spot because it was the best band I've seen in 10 years. And I was just flabbergasted.
Well, you know.
And I thought, they're there. Yeah. I missed it. They're called the Delta Saints.
Yeah. Oh, all right.
You know them?
Yeah. Before. I mean, you write in the book about at one point in the early 70s beginning to think that rock had just lost its way, and then along came David Bowie.
It happens. It always, yeah, right when you think it's over. That's happened to me a few times. And I'm really glad it happened now because, you know, as you get so much older, you start thinking, A, have I lost my taste for it? B, can I not relate to the youth culture? Or, you know, you go through all this. We all do. And then you go out and you see a band you love and you're back.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's like falling in love. So I've read that you're standing there and you think, no, there is nothing better in life than a great band. And there it happened to me again.
Yeah.
All right. But before I let the whole topic of feminism recede into the rearview mirror, the question I was going to ask you.
Well, you'd say that, wouldn't you? Because you're a man.
I just want to ask you what you consider to be feminism, because one of the early kind of standout lines in the book to me was you saying something to the effect that women's lib was basically a crock. That you
I
know,
said that in the book?
Well, those are not your exact words, but I can
no,
find...
No, I don't know that I said anything that was even new. That
so-called women's lib was rather misled by the pill. Women weren't in control of their bodies. The drug was.
Oh, okay. Well, I was, okay. I didn't know I said that. Okay.
So, I mean, it seems like you were really kind of ambivalent about what women were going through in the 60s.
I was only really very, very conscious of what one woman was going through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she wanted drugs. She wanted music. She wanted some more drugs. She wanted men. And, you know, not necessarily in that order, but, you know, just, you know, and we all did. We were all the same back then, you know. We were all conforming to be nonconformists. I guess that was part of it.
Yeah, yeah. So when you got to London, did you find that you were in a kind of a music scene where women actually had a place? You know, you had Vivian Westwood, you had eventually the
I've never
Slits
thought about gender. Does no one get this? I don't care about gender. I don't give a fuck. Je m'en fous. You know, I don't care about gender. I just don't care. We're talking about my thing is music. And it's what Charlie Mingus said in his autobiography. You know, musicians live on a colorless island. I've never met a guy in my life who wouldn't love to see a woman play guitar great or to sing great. They love it. Men love to see women play great. And they're open-armed to anyone who wants to get in a band and play. I've never, ever heard a man say, we can't have her. I've heard a guy say that they didn't like the sound of a woman's voice singing rock and roll, and that's a very valid thing. Some people don't like the sound of it.
You know, you mentioned Charles Mingus, and another one of the striking lines in the book is where you say, and this is somewhat later in the book, I wanted what the jazz musicians were looking for, the supreme. That thing that John Coltrane played an entire album to. Have you found that in music?
Yeah, I have. And I think that's the purpose of music. It's to connect you to the divine, and that it's a soul connection. And that's why all this stuff about gender and about, you know, what girls are wearing and stuff, it's so not the thing. I don't know what that is attached to and about. But with music, it's more about something that, you know, resonates in a much deeper pool of your... It's not even your consciousness. It's a soul thing.
And have you found, as you've, you know, gotten away from that teenage girl who liked everything hard, the music hard, the coffee hard, you know, the drugs hard?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm on.
Have you found that you've, you know, gotten into jazz, gotten into classical music?
Oh, I've
music
always liked other music. I didn't understand classical music so much when I was younger, but I understand it better now.
Mm-hmm.
And classical music was a young man's music. I mean, all Mozart and all those guys, they were all dead by the time they were 35. They were making at the height of their what they were doing when they were probably in their 20s.
Right.
You know, so I suppose you could say it was the punk of its day or the jazz of its day.
Right. There's a story in the book, in one of your crap jobs, there's a guy who plays arias from operas, and you just couldn't stand it.
Yeah, it freaked me out.
And then that same guy comes back years later and sings an aria at your father's funeral. There's a lot of those kind of cycling through your life.
That's right.
Do you see that as sheer coincidence, or...?
I don't know what coincidence means exactly, but I think... when things happen that are, when a lot of things happen like that, it just makes you feel like you're in the right place.
Yeah.
I don't know what it means or where that comes from.
So by the time of your father's funeral, had you converted to the Church of Opera?
I love opera, but that came more from hanging out with an opera singer when I was doing these proms about 20 years ago.
Okay.
And you know, and then I started to listen to it, and I thought, hang on, this is amazing.
Yes.
In fact, we were on this... yeah, it was UB40 and me and this guy on this proms in Antwerp, and this guy Alessandro Safina. And me and UB40 were going to gang up on this guy because he was, like, real good-looking. He was an Italian opera singer, and we thought we could really, you know, try to pervert him. But he was more nuts than all of us put together.
Yeah.
You know, and, I mean, then, you know, he got up and started singing, and we were all just gobsmacked. We'd never heard anything like it. He could sing in any language. He had the most incredible voice. I mean, we were all kind of fell in love with this guy. But we got back at him by making him sing it on the encore. And these guys, they can't sing rock and roll. They can't sing in English very well either. So we did get our own back. But since then, I've had a real soft spot for opera. I got him an Iggy Pop album, and he bought me a Maria Callas album.
Nice. Very nice. So what do you listen to now?
You know, the whole technology thing really fucked me up. I couldn't, as soon as the dial went and it became push button, I started getting lost. And, you know, downloading and listening to things on the phone and all that, I got very, you know, I kind of stopped listening to stuff when it was hard, and then record stores closing.
No, right.
And radio getting formatted. And, you know, it kind of lost me. Then I was reading a book, and I was trying to look up a... it was a... well, I'm not going to talk about the situation I was in at the time, but I was in a very kind of lonely situation. And I was reading this Garcia Marquez book, and I got to a word, and I didn't have a dictionary on me, and I like to get an exact my vocabulary is not very good, as anyone who will testify to read that book. It's a real easy read. And so I got to this book, and I got to this word, and I thought, well, I'll look it up on my phone then, because I know you can Google a word now. Mm-hmm. So I Googled the word lugubrious, and it took me right to this song by this rap artist called Little Ugly Mane. And he's been my favorite artist now for the last 5 years, and he's all I listen to.
Switch to the songs where I'm from. Yeah, I'm getting dumb. Yeah, I'm feeling numb. When that herb fill up in my lungs. My swagger acted foul, blacking out. Roofie up my absinthe in the club before I stagger out. Never died, rather take the ladder out. Take the ladder out. Rope around my neck and kick the ladder out. There's no need to drag it out. 28 grams, gotta bag them out. Standing in the rain, feeling bad about the mamas losing jobs over the rocks that I'll be passing out in vast amounts. Fast as I can trash an ounce, the first to come, the last to bounce. Counting pens, just put the block into a frenzy. The Glock is my appendage, I will pop you out the Bentley. Never catch a player acting friendly. Talking to the devil like he sent me. Boy, if you got big guns, throw them up. Break that hoe, split that Dutch. Stick them up, bitch, stick them up. We don't give
the great thing about this guy that I love is you can't find him.
Yeah.
His website's down, he's totally defunct. He doesn't want anything to do with us. Yeah, he's right off the grid.
So you move much of the story here is kind of divided by America, UK,
mm-hmm.
And it's fun to read an American's book set so much in London with the Britishisms that creep in even into your speech here today. And there's this funny story where you put paid to the old legend that you briefly married Sid Vicious so that you could get your, whatever the English equivalent of the green card is, mm-hmm. so you could get your residency. You did ask Johnny Rotten, you did ask Sid Vicious, you didn't marry either of them, but then you don't tell us. How did you legally stay in England?
Oh, gosh.
I was like, well, wait a minute. How did she do it?
Yeah. Well, it worked out in the end.
Okay.
I mean, okay, that, you know.
I don't want you
to
say anything that's going to get you in trouble.
You don't have to know. It's too late to get into trouble, but, you know.
You also say at numerous points in the story that you didn't want to be a solo artist. You wanted to be in a band.
Correct.
Always wanted to be in a band. Stiff Records comes to you and says, would you do a record with us? And you said, not if it's just going to be, you know, a Chrissie Hynde record. So last year you put out Stockholm. Mm-hmm. Finally, a Chrissie Hynde solo record.
Okay. You know, I'm so tired of being asked over the last many years, you know, but it's really just you, isn't it? And I'd put another Pretenders album. Yeah, but it's really just you, isn't it? And then I'd put another one out. But it's really just you, isn't it? So I went to Stockholm, and I worked with a couple guys who I didn't know, and I was coming out of some kind of cathedral which I'd been hanging out in while I was going to go meet this guy, Yucky, and I got these little bracelets that you buy on a card table when you're leaving, and it had, you know, it's just like a little wooden thing, and I walked in, and I said, look what I got you, and he went, well, what are those, Russian icons? And I went, I don't know, but that's the name of our band now. So then I took one to Bjorn, and I said, hey, look what I got you. And he went, what are those? I said, well, that's what our band is, the Russian Icons. So I started writing to them and saying, well, you know, dear Russian Icons. And I thought, and then what happened is they weren't prepared to leave their wives. They didn't want to move out of Sweden.
Well, Bjorn also has a band of his own, Peter,
yeah,
Bjorn, and John.
And their bands. And, you know, and be in my band with me, in our band, the Russian Icons. And then they all said, you can't call it anything. You've got to call it your name because that's more, you know, they wanted to sell records.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I thought, I guess if that's what you guys, I mean, it was, in fact, it was a more collaborative album than I've ever made in my life. Mm.
This lonely heart's been yearning, the skies above been turning, feels like the universe just grew. For so long, ah, I've waited for so long. Just wanna be with you.
The Damned. Have you seen the documentary? Don't You Wish We Were Dead? The documentary about the Damned.
Was it recent one?
It's new.
I don't think I've seen it, but I went and saw them play the other week. And guess who I saw playing with them? Who I've never seen before?
Who?
The Johnny Moped Band.
Oh, wow!
And I went to see them, and you know, I was so excited to see the Johnny Moped Band. So I ran in there because he's in the book, and I'd still never seen him. There was still a half an hour of seeing the Johnny Moped Band, so I was elated to see him finally after all this time. And then I watched The Dam. Amazing. I mean, the captain playing great. And there was it was just the captain and Dave Vanian.
Right.
Dave Vanian's an amazing singer. And he's so charismatic. And he's so, you know, all he does, his whole stage thing is just, he's wearing a black T-shirt, mm-hmm. jeans, and a pair of black gloves. And as soon as he's put those gloves on, man, it's Dave Vanian. It's amazing. that's all he needs, you know.
Yeah.
And
goth before there was such a thing as goth.
Yeah. So I saw the band, and then I finally can meet Johnny Moped.
Yeah.
So I went up to the stage, and I said, "Can I get back?" And they said, "Well, madam, you need a pass." And I said,
"Madam?"
I said, "Well, whatever he said." I don't think he said madam, but, you know. He said, "You need a pass." And I said, "Well, I said, "Okay, well, could you go backstage and tell Ray that Chrissy's out here?"
Yeah.
So they went and got the captain, and he came out and he said, "What? Chrissy, what are you doing here? You got to meet Johnny." So I could go on and on with these interesting stories.
There is a Damned documentary out there. It's called "Don't You Wish We Were Dead," and you, Chrissy, are in it.
Am I?
Yes.
Because I know I'm in the Johnny Moped one, even though I never met him.
Oh well.
Yeah.
No, you're in definitely in the one about the Damned. You and Lemmy from Motorhead, and
he's in the book.
He's in the book, and you know, the fact is, it was kind of like a big.
See, I didn't get in that Lemmy documentary. You know why? They chased me for 3 years to be in that. And the thing is, I really wanted to watch the documentary, and Lemmy plays a big part in my story. But if I'm in something, I can't watch it. So I really wanted to watch the documentary, and I thought I can't be in that because I'll never be able to watch the documentary.
There's no one faking it less than Johnny Moped. He was tailor-made for punk rock.
He was a legend back then. The captain and everyone just loved him and talked about him a lot.
Johnny Moped Band ended up on stage. You never knew what you were going to get at all.
His girlfriend was 40, and we all thought that was, like, you know, really... really radical.
Let me ask a couple of listener questions. This one is from Carrie in New York, who wonders, who influences your fashion style? And then she writes, "Your look is fab."
Pass. I don't know if Carrie, I don't know if you've ever been to the Summit Mall in Akron, Ohio.
All right. Eileen in Montgomery, New Jersey wonders, was it hard raising two daughters as a rock mom on the road?
No, because I didn't tour for 8 years. And they never came to a show because it was always past their bedtime.
And her follow-up question, any salacious detail not in the book that you'd like to share?
That depends on what you had in mind.
There is a scene in the book where you wake up in bed, you're not sure where you are again, and lying next to you, completely naked, is Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
And that's all we get of that scene.
That's all I got, too. No, the truth is, he wanted more.
All right. Moving on. Sue in Rochelle Park asks, what three artists would you like to work with and compose new music?
Lil Ugly Mane. Although I don't know his name or where he is or anything about him. Or, you know, so.
All right, but it's just a wish list. So.
Okay, my wish list. I'd still like to do some more stuff with Gaetano Moreno Veloso and Domenico Lancelotti and Cassin Cassin, who I worked with when. And I have a lot of stories about them.
You spent some time in Brazil, mm-hmm. right? Did you live there for a while?
I rented an apartment in São Paulo and then one in Rio, but I kept getting called back for, you know, rock and roll duties.
Yeah. See, a lot of those guys, you know, we think of them as this very kind of languid, languorous, tropical music, but they were the rock and roll. I mean, Caetano Veloso, you know, here's a guy who had to flee the country mm-hmm. because of his
That's
music.
That's Moreno's father, yeah.
Yeah.
He's amazing. Well, the interesting thing about those guys is Moreno's very, like, sort of samba bass, very sweet and soft, beautiful, beautiful voice. Cassin is a lot more quirky, punky. You know, his productions and everything add a whole different, like, almost Japanese element to the thing. And then there's Domenico Lancelotti, who's very percussive and very rock and roll. And, you know, the combination of those three is really unique. And that's the place to be if you like music.
From the rudder to the sail, oh, my boat is empty. Yes, my hand is empty. From the wrist to the nail, from the ocean to the bay, oh, the sand is clean. Oh, my mind is clean. From the night to the day, my boat is empty. My boat is empty. My boat is empty.
So, I mean, one of the great things about the first flowering of punk was it took music out of the stadiums, and you saw it in dive bars, and, you know, it was, and you write a lot about this in the book, it was the DIY, that I can do this too. I don't have to be a great musician. And the funny thing about the Damned was they were good musicians.
Yeah, they were good.
But most of them were just, they were learning as they went.
Uh-huh.
And you know, that kind of ethos.
They were living at home. They were guys living at home.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they were, you know, they had the opportunity to hone their craft a little bit.
But, you know, for most of human history, making music was a communal thing. And we had this, like, relatively brief moment in history where it became the province of specialists, you know? And the idea that you can be on a street corner or in a bar and playing music, you know, that kind of idea has...
Yeah, it's coming back.
Coming back.
It's coming back because, you know, there has to be more of a sort of musicians forum or a pledge that musicians take that's only for musicians about live music. So you play in small places, local places. The money goes directly from the audience to the musician. There's no middleman. Because it's very demoralizing now for musicians. And I know a lot of them who are really, really world-class great musicians who are almost living in poverty now. And they get a gig at a festival somewhere. And, you know, they have to schlep their gear in, and they play their set, they play their hearts out, they play great. Then they have to break down their drums and all this stuff, and they walk out with $50 in their pocket. And some disc jockey on the next stage pulls out a laptop and walks out with $5 million.
Yeah.
That's very demoralizing now to musicians.
Yeah.
Well, and it's a shame for live music, because it's kind of, it's not. It might not be killing live music ultimately, but it certainly is killing off the spirit of a lot of people who have devoted their lives to learning how to play their instrument.
So, you know, the industry has, it's dramatic, it's been a sea change, and you've gone through that whole period. I mean, writing this book, you're looking back at a period of time where you caught like the tail end of that huge wave of the record industry. And now, I mean, it must seem like a completely different job in a sense.
Not to me so much, because I'm very, I don't really get too involved in the business side of things. So with the way that the industry and the business changes, it kind of washes over me. I just don't pay much attention to that anyway. So from the point of view of what I do, which is just to, you know, write some tunes, play with the band, that never changes. That's always the same. But and that's just the way it is. You know, we don't change. The industry, the world around us changes. But
having said that, you have changed. I mean, that's part of the point of the book is, you know, that young woman who was out there, drugs, more boys, you know, louder music, harder, faster, more of it. You have changed.
Well, I mean, there's certain death signals, yes. You know, that, but, you know, I mean, the thing is, the changes that you're referring to, like with drugs and, you know, that's just an age thing. Everyone my age who's in this game, they come to the same conclusion. I mean, there's very few exceptions to that. You know, Willie Nelson stopped drinking a long time ago and just smokes pot.
Right.
As far as I know, Keith Richards has been on his health drink of vodka and orange for many years now. No one can sustain the level of, just physical abuse. You just can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, most people, if they eventually quit smoking because they're losing their voice completely, or, you know, it's just a thing in any business.
Yeah.
You know, so that's...
Well, another striking thing was even in, you know, this kind of drug-induced haze in the mid-70s, you write about one moment waking up and thinking, not where is my next band, but where is my next score, and alarm bells going off. That's the difference often between the people who survive and the people who don't, the people who hear the alarm bells and actually listen to them. How long did it take you to listen to that alarm bell?
Well, I wanted a band. So, I don't know. I mean, I...
Once you had the band, was that enough? Or did it take a while to kind of...
What, when I stopped doing everything?
Yeah.
Well, I was in my 60s.
So, like last Friday is what you're saying. So let me ask a few more questions from members of our audience. Felix from Brooklyn says, I've grown up with your music. My mom used to sing Kid to me.
Kid, what changed your mood? You got all sad, so I feel sad too. I think I know some things never outgrow. You think it's wrong.
Wrote this before you had children of your own. What was your inspiration?
It's really the story of a woman who is a sex worker and her son finds out what she does for a living. That's what the song's about. I don't know. I don't know if that pertains to this particular family.
Female artist of today that you like. No, no name on this one.
God, is it? I love Lana Del Rey.
Yes.
I love Cat Power. My pal, Sean Marshall. Who's awesome? Always awesome. Fiona Apple's terrific, amazing. Shirley Manson is always amazing. Juliette Lewis rocks. Amy Winehouse is, you know, I mean, one of the greats. We all miss her.
You've had some things to say about some of the pop side of, you know, women who are kind of either pushed into or choose to kind of build their career on their looks, you know.
Well, if they're pushed into it, they, you know, they're using a pimp, so they want to sort that out.
Mm-hmm. Is it any different now than it ever was?
I don't know. My thing is rock and roll. I can't really even comment on that. That's not my field, and I never really said anything about that. I'm asked a lot what my opinion on this stuff is, but I don't really have an opinion because I don't really know their music or what those people do. So, you know, it's kind of, to me, it sounds like disco music or something, and that's not really the thing. You know, that's not what I don't know what to say about it.
Yeah. Let me ask a serious kind of songwriting question, because at one point towards the end of the book, you write about this, and many creative people will know exactly what you're talking about, that you write a song and you have this momentary feeling of elation because you've written a really good song, and then almost immediately comes the sinking feeling that it's the last one and you will never be able to do this again.
I think you embellish that a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think anyone who writes anything goes through that.
Yeah.
You know, you write something and you get through with it and it's finished, and then you think, then you go right back to thinking that you can't do anything again. Because for the most part, see, the myth about, I think, about people in rock bands is that they're really, you know, confident and they know what they're doing. But for the most part, I find they're not. Usually they're sort of bumbling, insecure, not very, you know, socially, you know, maybe a little bit inarticulate. Their social skills aren't up to much.
Are they pretenders?
Yeah, well,
praise the Lord.
And so I think, sorry, you threw me there. What was the question?
the question was throwing this.
So I think once you finish something and you go back to being, you know, not very confident again.
Hmm. Well, Alice Cooper was recently on the program, and something he said struck me, which was, if you don't think that the next song is going to be the great song, then you should get out. You should just quit. I mean, which struck me from a guy who's been in the game as long as you have.
Longer.
Yeah.
And amazing band. I mean, the original Alice Cooper band was an amazing band. One of the greatest bands. In fact, probably people didn't notice that because he was so flamboyant and such a front person that they actually didn't notice what a spectacular band he had.
Wasn't Alice's guitarist originally from your neck of the woods?
Yeah, Glenn Buxton. Yeah, yeah. There's a picture of him in the book, which I took.
Well, you went back to Akron last month, and what's it like? I mean,
it's churning around. It's taken a long time, and I kind of had lost faith in the fact that this could happen because I made my own effort to really put something back into the downtown and see something happen. And I can't be there all the time, but...
You had a vegetarian restaurant there.
Mm-hmm. The Vegetarian, yeah. Yeah, but I wasn't there very often, and, you know, but I've got spirit there. Mm-hmm. And I've got ideas there, and I want to get a food truck in Akron and, you know, send it out to bike rallies and people that race trucks and go into, you know, my friend Annette's the Farm Rescue Sanctuary, Happy Trails, and on Saturday when they have an open house, I have the food truck go there, and wherever there are people, we'll send the food truck. And, you know, we can still sell our biker burgers and still get that shit out there. And so that's going to happen. And what I'm finding in cities like Akron, which is pretty much the typical story of cities all across America, the mall culture is collapsing now. People are tired of malls. People are traveling to Europe and saying, I like walking from my hotel and walking somewhere and being able to go to the corner shop. The real way to bring people back into the downtown area is through culture.
I went back to Ohio. But my city was gone. There was no train station. There was no downtown. South Tower had disappeared. All my favorite places. My city had been pulled down. Reduced to parking.
So if you're putting cinemas, if you're getting a museum, galleries, you're having venues, music venues, jazz clubs. Jazz is thriving again. People love jazz, and there's a whole jazz scene. So if you put, and this is what's happened in Akron, Ohio, with a friend of mine, Tony Tropi. He's got a jazz club. He's got musical where I saw the Delta Saints. He's got a art gallery. He's got a wine bar. He's got, you know, it's property's cheap. And, you know, he's carved out this whole world there, and people are going back there. They want to go back. And if you put culture into the downtown, that's what people will be attracted to. Right. And I hope more so than being attracted to going to see, you know, sports events, because they kind of should be outside of town, I think. But that's just my opinion.
All right, so you've got your West Coast band, you've got your Fools in London, you've got your stuff going on there in Akron, and, of course, The Fish to Sell.
Yeah.
The book is Reckless, My Life as a Pretender. Chrissy Hynde, this has been great fun. Thank you so
much.
Thank you. That does it for this podcast, but make sure to check out our archives of live performances, in-studio videos, exclusive music previews, and much more at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. See you next time.
Such a drag to want something sometime. One thing leads to another, I know. Was a time I wanted you for my